from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The marijuana debate is usually focused on legalization. California voters rejected that notion in November, but two states, Washington and Colorado, approved it. But recent reports about how large illegal pot farms go about their business have focused new attention on a different aspect of the debate, the environment. According to California's Department of Fish and Game, large-scale marijuana farms are endangering the environment by diverting water and exposing wildlife to pesticides. We'll explore what those big-time pot growers are doing and why environmentalists say it poses a serious threat. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. This is a story that begins with an animal you've probably never heard of, the fisher. The fisher is a rare weasel-like carnivore. Its home is in the northern forests of California, and it's being poisoned thanks to another resident of those same forests, large-scale illegal marijuana operations, which are utilizing a potent pesticide to protect their crops. And the plight of the fisher is only part of what's being threatened. According to a report this week in the Los Angeles Times, the big growers are also diverting streams, a practice the California Department of Fish and Game says endangers a much better-known species, steelhead salmon. Using marijuana for medical purposes is legal in California, but the clandestine large-scale growing operations on public lands are not. And the looming environmental consequences of those operations have sparked deep concern among not only scientists and environmentalists, but also among small-scale marijuana growers who fear they're also getting a bad rap. We're going to explore this topic in our first hour of Forum. Joining us to do that, Scott Bauer. He's a staff environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Game. He joins us this morning from Eureka. Scott, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Anthony Salvaggio. He is a lecturer in the Department of Sociology at Humboldt State University. He's an environmental sociologist with the newly formed Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. Mr. Salvaggio, thanks for joining us as well.
Good morning.
Scott Greeson is here, too. He's executive director of the Friends of the Eel River, a nonprofit dedicating to restoring the Eel River and its tributaries, one of the areas that seems to be threatened by these growing operations. Scott Greeson, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And Charlie Custer is here, too. He is a marijuana grower and co-founder of the Tea House Collective, a collective of Humboldt farmers who grow organic, sustainably farmed cannabis. We will be joined by Mr. Custer in just a moment. Scott Bauer, let's start out by just kind of getting focused, if we can, on what is going on and what you've studied. You looked at, in particular, this Eel River area. Tell us first where that is.
Oh, the Eel River is in Humboldt County, the Eel River is one of the largest watersheds in California. I believe it's the third largest. It flows through Mendocino and Humboldt counties, emptying into the Pacific Ocean around the city of Fortuna. So we're up in the extreme northwestern corner of California.
And when you studied this area, this roughly 35, 40 square mile area, you identified a number of marijuana farms. What did you find? How big are these operations? What did you observe?
Well, we actually have done two watersheds on both tributary to the South Fork Eel River, one being about 37 square miles. And in that watershed, we found total area of greenhouses. So we measured each greenhouse that we found, and we came up with about 218,000 square feet, which is an extensive area of greenhouse. And in each greenhouse, you can kind of roughly figure out size of a plant, and you can get a total number of plants. We counted outdoor plants, which are fairly easy to do on aerial photos, and we came up with, I believe, 14,000 plants, and then greenhouses included, and you get a pretty large amount of plants in a very small area.
Now, you've begun to identify, and I know some of this research has also been done by scientists at the University of California, Davis, but just give us a brief snapshot of the key environmental concerns. I mentioned in my introduction this animal I'd honestly never heard of, the fisher. What is being found that is affecting those animals, and why is that significant?
Well, the fisher is mainly affected, at least in the research that's being done, by rodenticides. And rodenticides are essentially, people put those out to kill rodents, kill rats, those kind of things. And what is happening is the fishers are either eating a poison rat or they're actually eating the rodenticide itself. And rodenticides are anticoagulants, so they thin the blood and they cause internal bleeding. And so most of the fishers that they are trapping in certain areas up here are either testing positive for anticoagulants in their blood or finding the dead animals. So that is a significant issue. But the issue that we're most concerned about, and we believe there's an extensive amount of grows that are non-cartel. And so grows
non-cartel that, meaning non-affiliated with Mexican drug cartels?
Exactly. And so those, we don't typically see a lot of rodenticides on those kind of operations. Our main concern is water diversion and land clearing. So everybody's putting, a pipe in a stream and diverting water for their operations, and we're finding that it's actually drying streams up here. So that's our main concern, and then the fact that a lot of land conversion is taking place. So they're taking oak woodlands, they're clearing the land, and putting these large grows on top of the clearing. So that's our main concern.
And Tony Salvaggio, as you look at this issue and have interviewed, I know, people in that area and are trying to get a grasp on sort of what people are doing and why, what's not getting enough attention in your judgment? When we talk about marijuana and all of the issues related to it, what do you wish people were focused on more?
I think there are two things that are not really part of the discussion. One is the cumulative effect or the ecological footprint of this industry, we really don't know, the ecological impact of it and the entire scale of the industry. We're looking at an industry that has, $15 billion annually. We have about 10 million plants that we find, that the feds find every year. So looking at the scale of that, I think we need to take into consideration the cumulative effects of this industry. And the other thing is the impact on humans, the illegal use of pesticides and herbicides, both on indoor and outdoor production. There's pretty much no attention given to this issue, except for of late with the folks that you have on the phone. And there's also really no data collection on this, and I think that's really important. We don't have anyone really doing rigorous scientific data collection on a large scale on this issue.
And is that directly connected, Tony Salvaggio, to the fact that this is an enterprise that sort of operates a bit in the shadows? We just don't have a good enough grasp as to how large it is and what's going on so that we don't understand its cumulative effects in the way we might be able to assess some other form of agricultural operation.
I think there are two things I think that are important to recognize about this industry. One, that it's unregulated because of the federal policy of prohibition. I think if we had a different policy, we'd see we wouldn't be talking about this. Uh-huh. I really don't think. And the other is having to do with this issue just around education. We're not educated. Consumers, growers, folks just aren't educated about these particular issues. I always bring up the example of paraquat in the 1970s. Folks domestically stopped smoking imported marijuana or were aware of this issue of paraquat, which was sprayed on Mexican plantations in the late 70s. So locals or folks in the United States stopped, smoking and demanding more domestic production. Today, we're supposed to be, more ecologically conscious and talking with pretty much just about every smoker, they have no idea about
right.
what is put into this stuff. So I think that's another element that needs to be really
well. And there's an interesting connection to that because, as you probably know, there's a lot of science that suggests that environmental exposure, especially to pesticides like paraquat, there may be a correlation between that and something like Parkinson's disease. And so there are – what you seem to be suggesting is that we may be – there may be exposures going on that would have long-term neurological impacts that we just don't know very much about?
Yes, yes. And in my research, and I've interviewed over 100 growers, grow shop owners, consumers and such, you know, what I'm finding is the majority of folks, and this is mostly indoor production, I should qualify that, the majority of growers use illegal pesticides during the entire vegetative and flowering stage of this growing this plant. Pesticides that were not tested for human consumption. They're tested for ornamental plants, for folks that work in the field, so tested about skin exposure.
Right.
Nothing for inhalation. So I can walk down to my grow shop right now and buy a pyrethium bomb, you know, and throw it on a plant and then sell it for $2,500 a pound, and people are smoking this stuff, and no one's ever tested. But that's, you could just go into any grow shop and do it, as well as illegal sales of other pesticides like Avid, and then carbofurans and other toxic chemicals. So, pretty regularly used.
Anthony Savaggio, a lecturer in the Department of Sociology at Humboldt State University. Scott Greeson joins us as well. He's executive director of the Friends of the Eel River, which is a nonprofit dedicated to restoring the Eel River and its tributaries. The Eel River, one of the areas that the Department of Fish and Game has been assessing. Scott Greeson, I mean, part of what's interesting as we hear Scott Bauer and Tony Savaggio outline this issue is that there's this basic conundrum, which is that because it's these large operations are illegal, it means by definition they're unregulated, and so we don't really know what's going on.
Exactly, Dave. And it's both, as you say, that they're unregulated and that we don't know really what's going on. We don't have enough good data, and Tony Savaggio is being a good scientist by pointing out the need for more research. But I got to say, as an advocate, we can't wait to find out for certain how serious these impacts are, because by the time we know the answers, it's going to be too late for species that are already at risk of extinction. We know these are serious harms. What we have to do is figure out what we can do to prevent these harms. And the thing I want to draw attention to is, as I think folks have already emphasized, the strong differences between these very distinct modes of growing and the threats that they present to specific species, ecosystems, and, you know, things we care about, whether it's global warming or the need to hold on to coho salmon in the South Fork eel. Those threats, we can't deal with them as, you know, distinct problems.
Yeah, so let's separate and sort of draw lines between types of growing and the environmental threats, Scott Greeson. I mean, how do you line them up? What causes which problem?
Well, I think you start with these, what I like to call trespass grows, what is commonly referred to in the press as the cartel grows, these very large-scale, completely egregious operations that are generally speaking on either public land or on timber company lands or large ranches. These are not only illegal, but they're done, you know, by operations that are really criminal operations top to bottom. Their focus is money, and they're willing to do things like carry guns, use poisons, completely dewater streams that just go way beyond what we see in virtually every other context. And that's where we see the problems in terms of carbofurans that are mentioned in the LA Times article, the threats to lots of wildlife, and especially to fishers, as Scott Bauer mentioned. Then you move on to the private lands, and I know from San Francisco it all looks like one great green haze, but in southern Humboldt and northern Mendocino counties, there's a substantial amount of territory that has been occupied by folks, you know, starting with the Back to the Land movement in relatively small pieces, 40s, 60s, 160-acre parcels. And there you need to look at the difference and the similarities between those Back to the Lander folks who first started the marijuana as a culture almost. It was both to make money and something they were doing for political and cultural reasons. And then the folks who have come in recently, mm-hmm. What we are calling the Green Rush, and that's what Scott Bauer is really talking about when he's talking about these hundreds of greenhouses.
So are there, Scott Greeson, problems with the what we imagine to be the sort of cultural phenomenon that you're describing that got started in the 60s with those small growers who are doing it by the book in California, which is you can form these small collectives to produce marijuana for medical purposes. And again, we are hoping to be joined by one of those growers, Charlie Custer. But are those, that style of operation, are those not an environmental threat?
They are less of an environmental threat, but they are still a serious threat in this respect. And Tony talked about the idea of cumulative impacts. The big one that we're worried about on the eel, and I'm most concerned about with Friends of the Eel, is water diversions and sediment impacts. So both taking water out and putting stuff into the water, both hurt fish. And coho salmon particularly need cold, clean water all year round, because for the first year of their life cycle, they have to stay in fresh water, unlike our steelhead and Chinook, which can run out to the ocean more quickly.
Well,
so the old school guys, you know, they do a lot of things right, but if they don't use winter rains and store them, then collectively they can still have a huge impact.
Yep.
But fixing that problem is a different question than fixing the problem of the giant trespass grows or fixing the problem of the newcomers who, frankly, don't really seem to have much of a clue about their impacts.
Scott Greeson, Executive Director of Friends of the Eel River, which is this area in far northwestern California that seems to be particularly impacted by some of these operations. We're going to welcome your calls in this conversation as well. What do you make of this aspect of the marijuana debate? So often we just focus on the question of legalization, but what about the environmental consequences? Is that something that ought to get more attention? And should that also affect the behavior of people, whether they're concerned about it for their own use for medical purposes or not? 866-733-6786 is our number, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Scott Bauer, back to you. As far as at the Department of Fish and Game, I want to get a better understanding of what Scott Greeson was describing as far as the impact on salmon. So water is being diverted because these plants suck up a lot of water. How much water is being diverted, and what's the specific impact that that's having on salmon?
Oh, well, you know, there's extensive data on the web where you can where growers tell you how much water it takes per plant, and a mature marijuana plant takes anywhere from 4 to 6 gallons of water per day. Now, in a watershed such as the one that one of the watersheds that we studied, you know, those streams in the summertime are flowing at roughly 1 to 3 cubic feet per second, which isn't a lot of water. So, if you have 20,000 plants in the watershed, and each one requires 5 gallons of water a day. And in the summertime up here, we don't get rain. I mean, we are a very wet region. We have, you know, a temperate rainforest, but in the summertime, it's very dry. So our creeks get very low, and of course, marijuana is being grown in the summertime, so the peak demand for water usage is when our creeks are the lowest. So in one watershed, you know, we estimated per season use of water to be over 10
wow.
million gallons for just outdoor plants and 7 million gallons for indoor plants.
And what does that mean for salmon then? If that water is going to feed marijuana plants, what's the consequence for the fish?
Well, that's a good question. You know, most of our salmon, our Chinook, our coho, our steelhead, especially coho and steelhead trout, they need to be in the creek all for more than a year. So essentially, the fish come up to spawn in our creeks. The adults die, or in steelhead instance of steelhead, they can go back out and spawn again. But the little juvenile fish are in the creek in the summertime. So if we take those creeks and we draw them down, or we make them so low that essentially they either become isolated pools or they dry up, well, obviously fish can't survive in a dry stream, or for that matter, they can't last very long on a stream that's been dewatered to the point that it's just isolated pools. So it's very important that there be good, cold, abundant water in the summertime so that those juvenile fish can get big enough and the following spring go out to the ocean and become adults.
Scott Bauer, staff environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Game. Tony Savaggia, do we know who these big growers are who are doing these big water diversions? I mean, I assume if they're illegal, they don't want to be known. I assume that they're not going to exactly welcome you and your students out there collecting data for various sociological studies, right? So what do we know about them?
Well, yeah, they're not going to open their arms for a walkthrough on their sites. But what I think an interesting thing that a student put together in one of my classes recently is a sort of a Google Earth tour from the sky. It's you can find it on YouTube, Green Rush Google Earth. And what they did was they took some of the aerial photos, aerial data from Google Earth, and just over a small section of the county, sort of took a look from the sky of the impacts and what they could see. And what they found was well over 600 sites where there were land that has been cleared for grows, major industrial greenhouses on sites, landslides visible from the air. So, you know, we don't know who they are, but, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out who they are with the technologies that we have right now. I mean, law enforcement is already well-versed in this stuff. So we know where some of these large grows are just from the technology that's available freely to the public.
And if it's illegal and we know something about who they are, Scott Bauer, I know you're not on the law enforcement side of the Department of Fish and Game, but it raises a pretty obvious question about why isn't more being done to shut these guys down?
You know, we have done some work on larger scale operations that were clearly, you know, there's clearly fish and game violations, but you know, our department is, you know, we're, for this region up here, including the Eel, we have maybe 15 fish and game wardens and maybe 12 scientists, you know, to cover thousands of square miles. And so for the scale of activity that's going on up here, we just don't have the resources. So we try and triage, you know, we've gone up in planes, you know, we've used aerial photography to find the really egregious grows where there's, you know, land clearing and obviously they're polluting streams or they have large ponds. And we've gone to those sites and you know, conducted some operations where we've, you know, written up violations of fish and game code. We never touch the plants. You know, our activities out there are restricted to what is impacting natural resources. So we deal with water pollution, water withdrawal, and we have done that. But, you know, the level of activity, as I think Tony has alluded to, is so big that it's almost to the point that we're totally blown away. We don't know what to do.
And we have to take a short break. But just in a word, Scott Greeson, does that satisfy you that there is that they're handcuffed by that lack of resources?
Well, no.
Okay, we'll leave it there, and we'll come back and hear more about what ought to be done with this problem when we return. We'll take your calls as well. We've got calls stacked up, ready to go. We'll take them after our break. 866-733-6786 is our number if you want to join us. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or concerns on our website or on our Facebook page. And we'll continue our conversation about the environmental consequences of large-scale illegal marijuana growing operations in far northwestern California when we return. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, large-scale illegal marijuana farms in far northwestern California and the impact they seem to be having on key environmental concerns, both in terms of water diversion, which may be affecting the fish, steelhead, salmon, coho, and also the impact of certain pesticides on a little-known carnivore called the fisher and what that may also portend for wildlife in the far northwest. We're joined by Scott Bauer, who is with the Department of Fish and Game, Tony Savaggio, a lecturer in the Department of Sociology at Humboldt State, Scott Greeson, environmentalist in that area, And we now have Charlie Custer with us, who is a marijuana grower for a small organic collective known as the Tea House Collective. We'll hear from Charlie in just a moment. But Scott Greeson, let me allow you to give more than a one-word answer to your concerns about the lack of aggressive law enforcement in the Northwest.
Well, I think you're putting a few words in my mouth there, Dave, but I'm not satisfied with the Department of Fish and Game's inability to target some of the really serious environmental crimes we're seeing. But frankly, I don't think it's entirely the department's fault. I think our whole system of addressing this industry has failed pretty catastrophically. And really what we're seeing right now is the collision between a system that's sort of divided between two minds, the federal prohibition and the state willingness to countenance medical marijuana, and an industry that is doubling in scale every year. It's expanding so rapidly that we, as I emphasized at the beginning, we need to find solutions where we can to each of these distinct problems. And I think what I'd like to see more of from the Department of Fish and Game particularly is really emphasizing the need for people to move to winter water storage. And they've done quite a bit on this front, but they need to do more. And I think that's true for all of us.
Though. Right. And so. And we'll dig down into some of those solutions. But let's hear from Charlie Custer now, who, again, is a marijuana grower, co-founder of the Tea House Collective, which is a collective of Humboldt farmers who grow organic, sustainably farmed cannabis for medical purposes, which is what is allowable within the state of California. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Give us your snapshot view of, as someone who's been in this business, trying to do it the right way for a long time, what are your concerns about what's going on in your literally neck of the woods?
Well, Scott really has nailed the situation. We see an exponential growth of exploitation, which leads to a scale of destruction never before conceivable, and we have no regulatory apparatus for addressing it. So we have to identify the really specific impacts from this gigantically growing industry in rural areas that have never had any comparable activity since they were stripped of fir and redwoods decades ago.
And what about your own smaller operation in terms of what you're doing to safeguard the environment? Because you also, I assume, do some things to divert water for the plants that you grow, or no?
Oh, sure. In our area, as Scott's very familiar with, we've been trying to get official county incentives to store winter water caught in abundant rains. And just catch it in the winter and use it in the summer instead of drawing any water out of the streams. And in our collective, we give incentives within the collective for people to do that, and also to not over-fertilize and to compost locally rather than bringing in outside amendments. Sustainability basically means independence, self-sufficiency. Those are our ideals. And if you do that, you hugely limit all of the environmental consequences of activity. But there has to be an absolute limit on the scale of exploitation in any location.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say about this problem and what they're thinking about this morning as we go through what these environmental consequences may be. Jim in Berkeley gets us started. Jim, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I agree that a lawful and regulated marijuana industry is the key to getting this to helping the environment. What has really hurt the Eel River watershed was 100 years of poorly regulated logging. And now there's a further problem where we have monocropping of vineyards that's starting in Mendocino and coming north. Marijuana is just one piece of the environmental problems that is assaulting the Eel River Basin.
Jim, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Tony Savaggio, how would you kind of compare various environmental consequences? Are we still living with those threats of the old clear-cut days? Is this equivalent to that? How do you put this in some sort of larger, broader historical context?
Well, I think your caller really brought up a very important point, is that we've moved from one monoculture to another. Rural areas have always been, in a way, the periphery where the resources are extracted and then sold away at a small price at a high price ecologically, but the rewards coming back to the county and to those regions are very small. So I think that's a really important comparison there. I think what's also important to recognize is the fish, you know, the impacts that the timber industry had were very large, and we have a recovering watershed. And now what's happening is we have, and Scott hopefully will talk about this, now we have another monoculture coming in and harming what we see as what we're trying to do is recover this region. So we have another impact. And I think what we're going to see, as Scott points out, is we're going to have more a larger scale grows coming down the pipe, especially with the legalization in Washington and in Colorado. As we saw with the last initiative, once an initiative gets on the ballot for legalization, growers, you know, they try to double their production. So we're going to see much more.
So you're suggesting that with what's going on in Colorado and Washington, that will drive greater growth in the Northwest to export to those now legal states?
Well, it's certainly going to put bring down the price, which is going to, you know, this is the economics is basically bring the price down. Growers are going to have to grow more to make their money. And we saw this the last time a couple years ago when the ballot in California for legalization was up, and we saw growers that I interviewed like, yeah, we're doubling it because this is our last run.
Yep.
So we also saw that in British Columbia too, folks. Increasing their output. And I think that the point that your caller makes back to this is, you know, the salmon and the fisher don't really care who does the impact. It's happening, and we have to recognize it. And we're not doing a good job dealing with this issue right now. We have to do better. And I think this conversation needs to be happening now in Washington and Colorado on a national level.
So is the issue then, Scott Bauer or Scott Greeson, I'm not sure who can best respond to this, but is the issue that we are just getting to the point of recovery from some of those old timber practices, and now we're back down the same, going to the same basic problem all over again?
That's sort of it, yeah.
Scott Greeson, go ahead.
The point, I think, is that but for those timber impacts, the incredibly severe impacts of deforestation-scale logging that we had, especially through the first part of the 20th century, we wouldn't have species in such trouble that the relatively lesser impacts of the marijuana industry would be driving them to extinction.
Yeah. Jim, thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to Joey in San Francisco. Joey, you're on. Are you with us?
Yes, here I am.
Go ahead.
Hi. I actually teach cannabis cultivation at Oaksterdam University in Oakland. And we teach both indoor and outdoor growing, actually have classes on organic gardening and conservation methods. So this is, you know, a wonderful topic. I'm glad you're having it today.
Thanks. Did you have an observation or a question to put forward?
Well, there are a number of things. I think on the legalization aspect, you know, I know you're focusing on illegal grows primarily, but in talking about the number of smaller growers, you know, that adds up and creates quite a large impact when you add it up over time. So I think what we're trying to focus on are those individual growers and ways that they can reduce their impact, talking about water conservation as well as the nutrients they're using, pesticides and things like that.
Joey, thanks. Scott Greeson, you made that observation earlier that small growers shouldn't be let off the hook here, that there's cumulative environmental consequence. Make that point again, and then I'd like to hear Charlie Custer respond.
Well, I think the point I made earlier is that even when you're talking about folks who are, generally speaking, small-scale, not over-exploitative, they're trying to work with organic practices, they run the risk when there are too many folks in a given watershed drawing water out of just sucking the stream dry, as Scott Bauer pointed out.
Yeah, and so, Charlie Custer, what are you doing to make sure that doesn't happen?
Again, water catchment in the winter so that families are assured of not needing any summer flows from from the river are the first critical step. The other issue that we haven't really discussed so far is eutrophication of the water from over-fertilization washing down the hillsides and into the water. And we're sharing information among ourselves about what size plant, how much fertilizer as well as water is necessary per plant to have good results without wasting resources that may then damage the environment surrounding us. But again, I agree with what Scott is saying. The biggest single way to address this issue, I would say, would be to put an absolute cap on the scale yep. of practices in any one area.
Charlie
or
Custer.
Any one parcel.
Charlie Custer, who is co-founder of Tea House Collective, a collective of Humboldt farmers who are trying to raise a cannabis in a sustainably farmed and organic manner. Charlie, thanks very much for contributing to our program this morning. Appreciate it. A couple of emails coming in that I want to get to. The environmental damage of these grows are similar to the out-of-control logging of the 80s and 90s. We have to get people to understand this. Another listener asks, what pesticides are applied? Please have your guests explain what these what insects are threats to marijuana and what insects what do they do to the plants? Someone else wants to know about what these rodenticides are. So maybe we may be merging, Scott Bauer, both insecticides and pesticides, but tell us what you can about what's being used.
You know, Tony could probably best answer this. He's done some great research on it.
Tony Savaggio, go ahead, please.
This depends on primarily the type of growing. You know, for outdoor, what we're seeing, and this is what's been found at some big industrial grows, are things like furadan, metaphos, floramite, avid. All of these are illegal pesticides, meaning that they should not be used on marijuana, and that you need a pesticide applicator's license as well as a pesticide dealer has to sell them to you. So we're finding these in grow sites. Furadan, which is a carbofuran, is basically banned in the United States, and it has been for some time. It's a bird killer, and that is basically watered into the roots. It's a systemic pesticide. So,
what are the dangers of it?
The dangers of furadan in terms of
both wildlife or potentially for the human population as well.
For wildlife, bird killers basically. Birds eat just a little bit of this and they'll die. It's got a high toxicity on humans of any insecticide used in any field crops. It can be fatal if inhaled and harm you if you're absorbed through the skin. So this has been banned for the last 3 years in the United States.
So this sounds, sorry to interject, but this sounds crazy, Tony Savaggio, because you said it's harmful if inhaled, and of course that's what you do with marijuana. So your point is that we don't really know, or people who are smoking don't know what they're taking in, and it may be potentially pretty disastrous.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that we're trying to do here is just educate people about these impacts, and there's no testing on any of this stuff either, and that's the other thing. Most of these things have been used basically for ornamental plants, so things like mites, spider mites, aphids, and other sorts of critters that harm marijuana plants, each of those things been used or for the ornamental flower industry, mostly roses and things like that, so none of this stuff's been tested by anybody.
Yeah, and of course, those are things that aren't consumed or smoked, at least so far as we know.
No. And then if you're a medical marijuana patient and your immune system is not up to par, then this is definitely something that needs to be considered.
Let's go next to Rosie in San Francisco. Rosie, go ahead.
Thank you. I have land in southern Humboldt and Mendocino and bought a property up there 15 years ago and been in the area since 30 years, and I got into a community. I knew they grew, but they were mom and pop. There was no problem. These plundering green rush people have come in, illegally put a greenhouse right on a stream, illegally graded, running diesel dopers, diesel generators, 24 hours a day, putting PVC on every inch of their property, With the vibration, I hear the owls are starving because they can't hear their food. The birds are disappearing. This is egregious. And I agree with your callers who know Humboldt and Northern Mendocino. This is heartbreaking to me. They are destroying the environment as bad, if not worse, than loggers. And there's not a goddamn thing that I can do. What do? Turn them in and have all my neighbors arrested or busted? This is egregious. They should legalize it and put the stuff in the valley. It's too cold up there, and mold gets on the plants.
Okay, Rosie, I'm going to hold you there. I hear your passion, and I want to get some responses to what you're saying. And someone who has also joined us on the phone now who perhaps can respond is Mike Jacobell, who's a 20-year resident of this part of California and an environmental activist. And you can hear Rosie's passion, Mike, and I know it's you want to make sure there's a distinction made between the kind of growing that's done by the sort of mom and pop operators who have been in that area for decades and these new growers.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I want to back up the work that Charlie and Tea House Collective are doing. I mean, he's said a lot of the things that I would say. You know, there is a way to grow right, and a lot of people are growing pot right up here in Humboldt County and Mendocino and whole North Coast. There are a lot of people. One of the problems, you know, I think is that it's not a lot of people know about it. You know, the trespass grows in the national forest and the poisoned animals and the dried up streams, those are the things that make headlines.
Yeah.
But people quietly growing organic and, you know, having a stack of water tanks to hold their water sitting there, it doesn't, you know, it's not flashy, it doesn't make headlines. And so a lot of people aren't aware. And so a lot of cannabis consumers, whether recreational or medical, don't even know there's an option.
Right. Let's take up your point that a lot of people are doing it the right way. And I guess I want to understand if that's possible and that we know that it can be done in the right way. Scott Bauer, let's start with you on that. Can it be done in the right way as Mike Jacobell and Charlie Custer are advocating?
You know, if the scale or the amount of grows weren't so significant, I would say yes. But what we're seeing, you know, in practically every watershed up here is, you know, 300 grows. And just like last caller Rosie had said about these people coming in from out of town, I can look at all the land ownerships and see that there's people from all over the United States coming here to grow marijuana. So, you know, you can store water in the wintertime, and you can grow, you know, marijuana probably sustainably. But the amount of people that have come here and the number of plants, I just am not sure that our watersheds, our creatures, our natural resources can sustain that kind of pressure.
Scott Greeson, what's your take? I mean, it sounds like something where there ought to be some way of regulating this so that you limited the number of people who were in this particular industry.
And Dave, you just said the magic word, regulation. That's exactly where we need to head, in my opinion, is not so much to legalize and declare open season, but to say you are allowed to do this if you have, you know, compliance with some basic standards, which would include the scale that Charlie Custer's mentioned, you know, the issue of water diversions, complying with the Department of Fish and Game's rules, submitting to inspections. And it's only when we have that system set up and actually implemented that we're going to get to a place where we can really know that we are preventing these really serious harms, and that, as Mike Jacobell has pointed out, that consumers are going to be able to know what they're getting and that it's green and clean. Now, that can happen, but the critical first step is that the federal government, the U.S. attorneys, are going to have to say it's okay for California to regulate the production of cannabis. And I think the moves by Colorado and Washington to legalize possession and cultivation are really putting the screws to the federal right. prosecutors. They're having to decide, are they going to let this happen or not?
Because it sounds like, as was noted earlier, because those states are legal now, demand is going to be so much, that much greater. So the problem's only going to get worse, right? And unless some form of regulation is put in place. Is that your
point? Actually, I don't think it's so much that demand is going to get greater. It's that prices are going to fall because there will be production in Colorado and Washington will definitely increase. There's no question of that. And because we do have a national market, even though it's a black market, it's a market. We've seen this repeatedly in California. When prices fall, people will increase their production because they're, you know, they're trying to make a land payment. They're trying to, you know, buy that truck. They have an income they're shooting for, and so they're going to plant, you know, twice what they did last year. And as Scott Bauer points out, that's twice as much water. So the question is, can we move this year or next year to actually set up a system of regulation? And the challenge for the state and for the counties is something I think we shouldn't underestimate. It's going to be very serious. We're going to need not only to set up a system, we're going to have to implement it. And that's going to mean enforcement. And it's going to mean enforcement not only in the traditional sense and going after those cartel grows with, you know, guys with guns, but it's also going to mean a different kind of enforcement of coming in and saying what you're doing on your land is okay or not okay. Yep. And we're going to need a lot of resources, a lot of patience to pull that off.
Scott Greeson.
It's not going to be an easy thing.
Yep. Scott Greeson, Executive Director of the Friends of the Eel River. Let's get in some more calls before we have to wrap up our hour. We're going to go next to John in Oakland. John, go ahead.
Hi. I guess most people know that industrial hemp has very low, typically low THC. Marijuana has very high THC. If you plant one industrial hemp plant within a six-mile radius of an entire field of marijuana, they will cross-pollinate, and the entire field will lose its potency and lose its marketability. You do that repeatedly for about 3 years, the guys may just give up and go away.
Okay.
Nice, simple solution. I thought I'd work that in.
All right. Thanks, John. I think all the solutions ought to be out on the table. We'll get some more solutions out as we can, and we've got another solution being offered now by Brian. Brian, what's your solution?
Yes. I'm proposing an unholy alliance with the federal government. Have them come in. The state allows them to go after the big cartels. The United States government wants to come in, it seems, to take the marijuana production out, either the clubs or the grows. And, leave the small guys alone. And the state says, listen, you know, we are allowing you to go after these big drug cartels. And that's it, basically.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian. I mean, Tony Savaggio, though, there's not a great history, is there, here? I mean, how long has the war on drugs been going on? And what success has there ever been in focusing on the big cartels or the big growers?
Well, I think, the point about prohibition, and I want to bring Scott's comments in, the prohibition's certainly failed. It's evidenced here if we just look at the landscape in Humboldt County. I think moving back just a second to that issue about legalization and the federal government's prohibition, I think what growers need to feel is they need to feel safe about being regulated.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they don't feel safe, so they're not going to work with local agencies to have them come in and walk their land and help them look at culverts and sedimentation and other things. And part of that is because of the inconsistent policies of the feds. They're trying to get data from Mendocino County on their medical marijuana program, and they're, taking them to court to get the names of people that have been involved in this, and that does not really help the this issue. Right?
Well,
does not encourage growers.
Yeah, Mike Jacobell, I'd like you to chime in on that. From the growers that you know, would they welcome that sort of come on over and walk my land?
No, most wouldn't. And it's for exactly the reason Tony said, this inconsistency. Mendocino had what maybe not a perfect program, but it was called the 9.31 program. It was the best regulation program that we've seen yet in the state, and the Fed shut it down. It was permitting growers to do it right. And it was saying, if you meet these guidelines, many of which were environmental, you can grow this amount. and the Fed shut it down. So, you know, part of the problem here, I was involved with a group in 2010 when we were facing the possibility of legalization in California with Prop 19. I was working with a group here in Humboldt, you know, trying to craft a local ordinance, a Humboldt County medical marijuana ordinance, and you know, all that just got stopped when the Fed started clamping down, because what is the point of doing it if we can't actually implement it?
We just have a minute left, so just 20 seconds from each of you on what the consequences are if we don't face up to this problem, the environmental consequences of what we've been discussing this past hour. Scott Bauer.
Well, the Department of Fish and Game and federal agencies are worried that we may lose coho salmon from California, or at least from this region, if we don't deal with this issue.
And Tony Savaggio, what do you think's at stake?
Coho salmon. I agree.
And Mike Greeson, sort of put your ribbon around this this topic and why you think it needs more focus and more attention.
This is Scott Greeson.
Same thing, salmon and fishers and other wildlife, and the integrity of our national forests, and, you know, I hate to say it, but it's a secondary thing, but the integrity of the Humboldt economy. People here want to keep the pot economy going. You know, they're dependent on it, but if the reputation gets so trashed that no one wants to buy Humboldt weed, it's going to impact people here.
And Mike Giacobbo, you'd probably second that, right? There's a sort of culture and sort of civic life that's at stake, too.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's the history. People here are very tied to the pot economy. There's not a lot else going on. I mean, I'm not talking about the cartel grows. I'm just talking about the established community here. And there's a lot of people not just worried about the environment. I mean, that's the main concern, the fish, the fishers, and the forests. That's the main concern. But a lot of people are looking at their, you know, looking at their long-term picture, long-term community reputation as growers. You know, they don't want to be associated with this environmentally destructive practices of other people.
Fascinating topic. Thanks all very much for being part of it. Scott Bauer, Tony Savaggio, Scott Greeson, earlier Charlie Custer, and Mike Giacobel as well. Thanks very much for participating in our program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, with additional producing help this week from Vinny Tong and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer today, Howard Gelman. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.